MAGA frenzy over the Jeffrey Epstein files are the voices of survivors of the sexual abuse he perpetrated against them. Many, like our next guest, have joined the call for transparency and for the Trump administration to release the files as promised. This comes as Virginia Giuffre, an outspoken survivor of sex trafficking by Jeffrey Epstein, died apparently by suicide at age 41 in April. She was the first survivor to come out publicly against Epstein and his co-conspirator, Ghislaine Maxwell, who remains in prison. She also sued Prince Andrew for sexually assaulting her when she was 17. The disgraced prince was forced to step away from his royal duties and settled with Giuffre in 2022. Her family said in a statement, quote, Virginia was a fierce warrior in the fight against sexual abuse and sex trafficking. She was the light that lifted so many survivors, unquote. Just last week, when the FBI and Department of Justice announced there was, quote, no incriminating client list, it also said Epstein harmed over 1,000 victims over two decades, far more than previously known. For more, we're joined by Teresa Helm, who is a survivor of sexual abuse by Jeffrey Epstein, facilitated by Ghislaine Maxwell. She was assaulted by Epstein in the early 2000s. She now works as the Survivor Services Coordinator for the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. Her 2024 piece for Newsweek is headlined, I'm a Jeffrey Epstein Survivor. The documents are an opportunity. Thank you so much for joining us. You, Teresa Helm, have talked about the dangers of grooming. As you see all of this taking place, the uprising within the MAGA movement, lost are what sexual violence survivors go through. Talk about how you first met Jeffrey Epstein, how you were brought to him, how you were groomed.
Well, hello, good morning. I can certainly talk to that. So I was attending college out in California at the time and was a full-time student and a full-time employee there. And so that began the process of recruitment to grooming, passed along the line from various people as far as this is an opportunity that I'd like for you to see if you're interested in and go talk to this person. So after speaking with a couple young women about an opportunity that I was thought I was being blessed with at the time, I eventually met with Ghislaine Maxwell, who really what she did was pretty astounding in the fact that within a day, I was convinced that I was in a safe, healthy, wonderful environment, blessed with an opportunity to pursue a career that I could had only dreamed of having. In fact, that was my dream to do what she had stated I would do alongside her, working for her. She was very polite and kind. She built trust in a very, you know, within hours, I thought that I had really landed the opportunity of a lifetime. My family was very pleased that I was there interviewing with her, which is what the intention. That's what the that's what I thought I was there for, was an interview. And things went so amazingly well. And then she was so successful in all of that very, I would call it, you know, master manipulation. She was very calculated in her craft and did it very well. I was very young. I mean, I was an adult, 22 years old. However, I had such big dreams and aspirations and determination, and really wanted to make the most of this opportunity that I thought that I was getting, to the point where at the end of my time with Ghislaine Maxwell, although I hadn't known that there was a partner, as she referred to him, that I would be meeting at the end of my time with her. I hadn't heard Jeffrey or any other person's name the entire time from beginning sitting behind the desk at work in California at the college, to meeting Sarah Kellen at the beach, to who then introduced me to Gielen. I had no idea that there was a final person that I was going to go meet. And once I learned of him by the name of Jeffrey, I did not, I paused and thought about some things, waved any kind of red flag in my mind, because again, she was so, Gielen was so, so good at what she had done and built that trust in me. And so then I walked myself to Jeffrey's home later that day to what I thought was to interview with him, without really a lot of question, actually being quite excited, because I thought, well, if I was so successful here with Gielen, which he has really made me believe that I have been, now I get the opportunity to go complete this, like a second round of the interview. And that was really, I walked myself into tragedy. I had no idea. I actually should, and I will reframe that. I didn't walk myself into tragedy. I was lured there. I was coaxed there, coerced there, under false and fraudulent, you know, conditions and expectations.
And it was there. It was then that Jeffrey Epstein assaulted you.
That's right. They're in his very big, beautiful home there in Manhattan. You know, the home that Gielen was raving about after I had been complimenting her on her home and speaking about the different various buildings and the architecture and how much I enjoyed it and comparing different cities to New York. And then she raved about his. If I thought hers was great, wait till I see his. Yeah, so it was there.
Mm-hmm. So you have joined the call for the Epstein files to be released. Can you explain why you feel this is so important?
Where I stand with all of this is in, you know, utter solidarity with survivors of this entire nightmare that's just been going on, you know, ongoing for decades with these people that have gotten away with so much for so long. You know, whether it was a failure of the system back in the 90s, whether failure of the system again in the early 2000s, there are so many women and at the time even, you know, children that have been harmed by these people. I really urge everyone to focus the commitment, the intention, all this time, effort, and energy onto bringing to light what needs to bring to light for these survivors and their healing, and less about political weaponization of anything, because at the end of the day, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about people's lives, and it should not be weaponized either way in any administration. No matter who's in control at the time, who did what when, who's doing what now, transparency is key, because we cannot move forward as a society and as a culture without these fundamental changes of doing the right thing and holding people accountable, because we can't continue to have systems of power that just get away, or people, whether it's a system or a person, we cannot continue to have these people or systems continue to get away with anything that they can get away with, because they're skating through, they're dodging accountability. There's too much money involved. So, you know, people silence through money. We have got to change that. It's degrading our society to continue to allow these predators and perpetrators to get away with harming so many people. You know, those that harm and exploit, they have to be silenced, not the survivors continuing to be silenced. Because when you don't have accountability, you don't have justice. We are so far out of balance with justice. It's almost like, you know, Lady Liberty, she can take a small step to the ground, because we're so uneven where survivors are holding on, clinging on to the hope, which tends to be, you know, one thing that you can't take away from a survivor. It's how we get here. We survive through it because we have so much hope. But hope tends to get shattered often. We have, and it's like, the onus is on us to pick up the pieces and try to get louder and louder. You know, our silence is not, it's very loud within us. We have to then, you know, we're tasked with rising back up, fighting bigger, fighting louder, you know, screaming from the mountaintops. Like, who is going to do something? Because we are setting horrible, horrible influences to our children and to our youth of what you can and can't get away with, depending on who you are, what position you are in. And as I said, I just feel like some, you know, oftentimes we have these huge profile cases where people are harming others. And there's just such a big, you know, did this really happen to you? Well, if it did, what about this? We have to get to the point where we are survivor focused in the justice system, because we're such a huge part of it that we have to stop politicizing everything and listen to the survivors, listen to the ones that have the lived experience. You cannot take this experience. People can say there's nothing there. You cannot take the lived experience away from us. Not that we wanted it in the first place, but here it is. It lives with us. It remains with us. We're fighting for justice. You cannot take away our lived experience.
Well, Teresa Helm, I want to thank you so much for being with us. We're going to link to your piece, I'm a Jeffrey Epstein Survivor. The documents are an opportunity. When we come back, we're going to go to Ro Khanna in the Capitol, who is introducing a bill to deal with the Epstein files, to have them released. Stay with us. Poem by Mourning a Black Star in our Democracy Now! Studio. Thursday marked the 11th anniversary of the police killing of Eric Garner, who died after a New York police officer held him in a chokehold. Eric Garner's pleas of I can't breathe, captured on video by a witness, became a global rallying cry against police brutality. The now ex-NYPD officer Daniel Pantaleo remains a free man after a jury and the Justice Department declined to charge him for the killing of Eric Garner. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. In a growing political storm for President Trump, some Democrats have joined his MAGA base in pressuring President Trump for more disclosures of the Epstein files. Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna introduced a measure with Republican Congressmember Thomas Massie of Kentucky. At least 9 Republicans signed on to the so-called discharge petition, which requires 218 signatures to bypass House leadership and force a vote. Congressmember Ro Khanna joins us now from Capitol Hill. Congressmember Khanna, can you lay out what you're calling for and where it stands now?
It's pretty straightforward. We're calling for the full release of the Epstein files while protecting, of course, victims' identity and making sure no child pornography is released. The bill that Thomas Massie and I have introduced has every Democrat backing it and 9 Republicans. That means that when we can have the discharge petition, we will be able to get a vote on it. Unfortunately, the Republicans blocked us from getting a vote last night. They could have just had the vote last night. We have to wait until the August recess is over to be able to do the discharge petition. But as soon as we come back after Labor Day, we will be able to vote on this and we will pass it.
How do you respond to President Trump saying he wants to release the grand jury testimony? This is a tiny fraction of the documents. And of course, though, it's the only set of documents that would have to be approved by a judge.
Well, he's doing that in response to Massie and my bill. I mean, he is, it's not a coincidence that he announced that last night before the bill was allowed to be voted on the House. He was trying to ward off the Republicans from allowing a vote on Massie and my bill. But as you pointed out, the grand jury testimony and grand jury files largely concern Epstein and Maxwell. They're the ones who were prosecuted. It will not have the witness interviews that really implicate the rich and powerful men who were potentially engaged in sex trafficking. It will not have a lot of the emails and the texts. And as you pointed out, it requires a court order to unseal those files. Typically, courts are reluctant to do that. They may in this case, but there's a lot within the Justice Department that the Justice Department could release, and they can do so while protecting victims' identity.
I wanted to switch gears and ask you about the massive blow to public media and local news. The House gave final approval to the rescission package that strips $1.1 billion from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which funds over 1,500 NPR and PBS stations across the country. Rescission has not been used for more than a quarter of a century. It allows for the president to request Congress to claw back funds already allocated using a simple majority. White House Budget Director Russell Vogt praised the rescission vote and indicated it would come into more frequent use. He spoke to reporters yesterday.
Will you ask Attorney General Pam Bondi to release more documents to finally put this controversy to bed?
Yeah, whatever's credible, she can release. If a document is credible, if a document's there that is credible, she can release. I think it's good. But it's just really, it's just a subject. He's dead. He's gone. And all it is the Republicans, certain Republicans got duped by the Democrats, and they're following a Democrat playbook. And no different than Russia, 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 and all the other hoaxes. They're started by the Democrats. And some Republicans, in this case, I was surprised, but they got duped.
We're now going to go to the right side.
We're looking forward to the House blessing the Senate package. I'm not worried about it. We need to get it done and get it across the finish line. But a very historic moment, the return of using rescissions, getting the muscle memory for that back into the system. We've talked about defunding Corporation for Public Broadcasting for decades. President Trump's the first one to be able to do it. He had a lot of enthusiasm for this package, and we're just thrilled that we made it through that critical juncture last night.
Before joining the administration, Vogt was policy director at the Heritage Foundation, author of Project 2025 that called for ending funding for public media. The federal government has been supporting public media for more than half a century. Congressmember Ro Khanna, can you talk about this campaign against public media and how the entire funding of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was just clawed back?
Well, it's a devastating blow to the education of our children in America and to our democracy. Let me put this in perspective. They got cut the public broadcasting funding, which is about $1 billion. At the same time, just last week, they voted for tax breaks for billionaires that added to the deficit $3.8 trillion. That means 3,800 times more than the cuts to public broadcasting suggesting were the tax breaks to billionaires adding to the deficit. So it's just not true that this has anything to do with fiscal responsibility. What it will do is deprive our children of things like Daniel Tiger, educational programming. Private corporations don't do that because they don't have the money to invest in social and emotional research. I highly recommend your viewers watch Fred Rogers' testimony explaining why we need public educational programming. What it will do is cut NPR and PBS that invest money in sending journalists to places where people don't have health care, to places where there's poverty, where there's low wage, things that broadcast television, that paid television don't want to cover. And so it is a devastating blow to our robust democracy and education.
Congressmember Ro Khanna, I want to thank you for being with us. Democratic Congressmember from Silicon Valley, Vice Chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. As we stay on this issue of defunding the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which will impact the entire public media ecosystem built up over decades, but some local stations and communities depend more on CPB funding than others. For more, we're joined now by Loris Taylor. She's the president and CEO of Native Public Media, a member of the Hopi Nation. Her recent article is headlined, "When a Station Goes Dark, We Lose." Welcome to Democracy Now!, Loris Taylor. I want to thank you for being with us. Nearly 60 tribal stations are a part of Native Public Media. Almost 36 of those stations have CPB, community service funding. Can you talk about what this means for the country, this complete ending of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting?
Well, this news has been really devastating to Indian country. We have tribes in Arizona, Navajo, Hopi, the Tohono, White Mountain Apache, the Alaska Natives in Alaska, and our relatives in the Midwest who are impacted by this decision. These stations provide news, emergency communications, educational content, and other information to really fulfill the information needs of tribal citizens, and to have a sweeping decision that's this profound and this impactful is going to really hurt Native communities.
And can you talk about what exactly these stations provide for their communities? For example, early warning systems.
Well, let me talk about the alerting system capability of stations. Our stations are able to send out emergency alerts over the radio and television. They're able to connect to the wireless emergency alert system as well. And one of the things that's going to be impacted in this case is the new missing and endangered persons alert that was just approved by the FCC on August 7, 2024. It's scheduled to go live September 7, 2025, and to have 36 stations taken out of the system is going to be a hit. As you know, Native Americans suffer, you know, twice as much to violence, and there are a lot of missing and murdered women and indigenous persons cases, over 10,000 right at this time.
You wrote a letter to the South Dakota Republican Senator Mike Rounds, urging him not to vote for the rescission package. Senator Rounds did vote in favor of the package, but in a statement wrote, "In order for me to support this legislation, we had to find a way to continue support for these radio stations, which offer potentially life-saving information in some of the most rural parts of our nation. These stations play a vital role in South Dakota, delivering critical emergency alerts and public safety information. They need to be protected. I work with the Trump administration to find unused climate change money that will be reallocated to continue grants to tribal radio stations. I'm pleased we secured $9.4 million to make certain the dozens of tribal radio stations receiving CPB community service grants across 11 states can continue operating without interruption." Can you talk about the significance of this, how you responded to this?
Well, first of all, I want to acknowledge, I'm thankful to Senator Rounds for placing tribal stations on the national agenda. But here's the deal. We've heard about this deal after it was posted on X. I'm not a subscriber of X, so it came to me through other means. We have not spoken with Senator Rounds. I did write a letter expressing my concern that Green New Deal monies are climate and energy dollars, and it's a visionary framework that has no funding ability that I know of, and it does not authorize funding for public broadcasting. So I wanted to know, how is this going to work? As you know, CPB is explicitly designed to manage appropriations from Congress on behalf of the 1,500 stations across the country. There are mechanisms that are already in place. There are compliance requirements that we have to abide by. So my question was, give me details. How is this going to be accessible? Does it need congressional authority? Are there other legislative measures that need to be taken? I don't have any answers to this day.
Loris Taylor, can you talk about the importance of native public media during the height of the COVID pandemic?
Native public media was called into action during COVID. And if there's any time or crisis that has demonstrated the need for local information systems, it was COVID-19. COVID-19 hit Native American communities. We were devastated by it. Hundreds of individuals died across nearly every single tribe. Some tribes were hit so much that they worried that they would become extinct. And so what we learned was that people want to be informed in real time when a crisis hits. During COVID, they wanted to know about hospital protocols, where to find equipment or PPE safety gear, where to find food, whether or not there were roadblocks. And so there was a lot of information. And as you may recall, this information need was really fast moving. And so we learned from COVID-19 that our stations are there. There are safety hubs. They're about our public health, and they're also about our civic health. And now to have that stripped away, I'm afraid that with the climate crisis increasing, that we are going to be operating on the margins of information and are not going to have real life saving information available to our citizens when they need it most. That's disheartening.
And finally, we just have 20 seconds, but the preservation of indigenous languages spoken on your stations.
Well, that along language speaking programs by Navajo, Hopi, and all the tribes that were once stakeholders in public media may go silent. And I just want to say that public media is for everyone. Mm. But I'm not going to let this moment silence Native American voices. We're going to move into recovery and see what we can do to stabilize the system.
Loris Taylor, thank you so much for being with us, CEO and president of Native Public Media, a member of the Hopi Nation, joining us from Flagstaff, Arizona. Want to end today's show congratulating our producer, Hani Masood, and his wife, Aisha, on the birth of their daughter. Welcome to the world, Safa. And a fond farewell to Tammy Warrenoff, who's worked with us as a producer since 2018 as part of our amazing Headlines team. We wish you all the very best. You are now a part of our DNA. That's Democracy Now! Alumni. We are hiring for multiple positions. Find out more at democracynow.org/jobs. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
Is that a normal part of your segment? That's the way I've always sung. This is my song.
Are there subliminal duets?
Absolutely not.
The Metal Meltdown, a show that brings you melody-driven heavy metal from around the world. Melting your ears every Monday night from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.